Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of Free Washington, Spokane Valley, brought to you by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican in the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. It's not about right or left. It's about right and wrong. It's about doing the hard work to implement freedom, because our hope is not in man, but in Jesus Christ. And we can't end in prayer. We must also move to action. And as Exodus 15:3 says, the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Are we warriors? Now, there's a part of being a warrior that we don't talk about because it's hard. And that is, you still got to march forward in the mud and the rain and the cold with the heavy pack on, with all the stress of whatever mission you've been given. And as Christians, I think we look at hard times as a negative. And I want to talk about that a little bit today. We've, you know, I don't know about all of you out there in Patriot Radio land, but this has been one heck of a year. There's been a lot of hardship, a lot of pain, a lot of attack, a lot of just negative stuff. And then on the flip side, there's been some just super rewarding things this year. But this year kind of stands out to me. This is a year that stands out more than in any other year in my, at least my adult life. And you know that you're on the right path when you're getting attacked. You really do. As a Christian, we should expect that we're going to have to walk through the mud and the cold, the heavy weight of the pack. But we have an outlet when we can lay all that at the foot of the cross and just say, Lord, take these thoughts captive and just lay them at the foot of the cross. All the fear, the worry, the anxiety, the weight of things, the fact that it just doesn't seem to let up, we can all lay that at the foot of the cross. And that's part of being a warrior that isn't really talked about much today, but it needs to be. Because the craziness that's going on in the world around us, craziness in our own lives, it can get you down. October was a terrible month. Terrible. But it can get you down. But you know, if you lay it at the foot of the cross, God's going to vindicate you. Doesn't matter what the attacks are. Doesn't matter how slanderous and evil and just absolutely corrupt the enemy is. You can lay all those things down at the foot of the cross. Find peace. And God knows that you need help. God knows that you need help fighting battles, but we just actually have to acknowledge it and accept it and receive it instead of trying to take it all on our own, ourselves. And rest in the fact that corruption, the evil, that the liars and the betrayers will be exposed. We need to take heart in that. It will happen. In this life or the next, it will happen. And they know who they are. They know they're wrong. They know what they've done is wrong. They know that attacking you or attacking me is wrong. But as Christians, we should not be surprised by it. And also, we should take heart in the fact that the Lord uses these times to harden us in a good way. I was listening to the process for hardening knives the other day. It's superheated and then super cooled, you know, one extreme to the other. And that's how the knife becomes hardened. And it's similar to Christians. We have to go through superheated times of our lives, super cool times of our lives. But all of it is for the purpose of hardening us in Christ Jesus. And I think that's the good message to everybody today. I hope it encourages you, because without the hard times, we wouldn't really be improved. If you think about it, all through life, it's that way. You remember the lessons from the hard times. You don't want to go through it, but you can see some of the good that comes out on the other end. And that brings us now to your daily intelligence briefing. On the international front in the Middle East, again, not very much talked about, but the Kurds capturing some Syrian oil fields after giving up the oil fields around Kirkuk to the Iraqi army. This looks kind of like there might be a deal. Also, Debka file has some unconfirmed reports of an Israeli airstrike over the Syrian town of Homs. It looks like 7 missiles near Homs. So some things kind of ramping up in Syria as well. More rhetoric coming out of Iran that the United States is, quote, the number one enemy. Now, look, they've been saying this for years. It's not news, but it's the fact that these things are kind of ramping up over there and that there are some Shia militias and Shia-backed troops in northern Iraq working against the Kurds. And looks like the Russians so far are kind of staying low-key. But, you know, kind of hidden behind the scenes is this ongoing strife between the Sunnis and the Shias. Now, I exclude the Kurds from that conversation, even though they're Sunni, because they really see themselves as a distinct ethnic group. And you're seeing this with the Saudi Arabians coming out and saying they're going to go moderate, also taking some steps to begin a nuclear program and with nuclear power. But the reason you do that is to begin a nuclear program. And then 58 killed in Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood, Sunni faction. And then Iran with its rhetoric, a Shia faction. So the Middle East continues to be a tinderbox. And the United States needs to have very clear strategic goals and very clear rules of engagement. In fact, my guest is going to be talking about those rules of engagement today. I know many of you that served in Vietnam were just livid at the rules of engagement there. We had some issues with rules of engagement when we were in Iraq, too. And some senior commanders would not listen to us in some of our suggestions. Some did. But we're going to talk about that, because if we send troops overseas, we have to have a clear strategic purpose. We have to do it constitutionally, and we have to have good rules of engagement. Also on the international front, North Korea continuing to threaten this collapse of the nuclear testing site, 200 people dead at the beginning of October, finally coming out now via study. 3 aircraft carriers there. Just really, really tense situation. And the fact that it's quiet right now is a little disconcerting, at least to me, because, you know, the more they talk, fine. And there, I know there's negotiations going on behind the scenes. But the fact that it's quiet just really, that's when I start watching to see if there's any little tip-offs of maybe where things are headed. But, you know, Mattis's last statement of the threat of North Korea nuclear attack is accelerating, quote-unquote, I don't think bodes well. Also, the fact we have three aircraft carrier groups there is a sign there's a prelude to war. Now, you look also for the redeployment of large bodies of troops. I'm talking like brigade and division level sizes of troops. You look at the repositioning of missile defenses, which some of that is already happening. You also look again always at logistics. You know, is there logistics ships in the area? So on the logistics side of it, the answer is yes. Three aircraft carriers, the answer is yes. There is a repositioning of some, and obviously they're going to be very quiet about this, missile defense. So now kind of looking for the repositioning of troops, and I have heard that some of that has been going on discreetly. So we're going to keep our eyes on that part of it. But those are things you look for when you are analyzing whether or not conflict is going to break out. And again, I hope Congress takes this up and doesn't do the route of, you know, authorization of force, but actually goes through the constitutional process for debating this, putting it out publicly. Also on, and you know why I say that? Because I have a problem when we go overseas. If it's been debated, it's voted on by Congress, we're good. Everybody should get behind it. All the representatives, there's a public debate, all that stuff. When you have these kind of ad hoc things, it's like having, you know, one parent rooting for you and the other parent rooting against you when you're on the soccer field or the baseball diamond or something. And the purpose of having the Constitution say there needs to be a declaration of war is so that we actually do that. So I hope if there is something that is going to happen, that there is a debate about it, and it's done constitutionally. On the international front as well, Catalonians continue to be defiant, even though the government was sacked by Spain. Peaceful protests have been advocated, and there have been protests breaking out all over Spain, but particularly in Catalonia. I don't know. I looked at a map. I'll share this part with you. I looked at a map of the dozens, I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of European autonomy or independence movements everywhere. Just amazing. And I think the trend line is that they're going to continue to have regions seek more autonomy. And what we are beginning to see worldwide, but particularly in the West, is something called the resurgence of neo-tribalism. The idea that ideological, cultural, value systems, belief systems, heritage, tradition, all of those things are now having the effect of devolving the centralization of control in nation states that has marked the last 400 years of Western history. And the more the Spanish crackdown, so I mean, for example, Catalonia's government was, nine members anyway, were ordered to be jailed on Thursday, investigated on sedition, rebellion, and embezzlement. I don't know how embezzlement works, since they're the productive region that sends money to Spain, but whatever. Rebellion and sedition, I mean, you keep cracking down and not recognizing the trend of history that we're headed back toward neo-tribalism and this devolution of the nation state to better reflect the cultures, traditions, values, heritage of a people, the more we're going to have these problems. And it's, the answer is not going to be crack down on them and they're going to go away. I mean, the Catalonians lost a major battle against Franco in 1938. They remember that. They still in near history. And they're urging civil disobedience, but ultimately these things, when the crackdowns happen, it begets force upon force. And so when Milan and Venice, although it's a kind of first stage vote, voted 95% for autonomy, we should take note of that because that's, again, the most productive part of Italy. And the fact of the matter is that Catalonia did something similar a couple years ago, and that vote was recognized by their government at that time. This vote was recognized by the Italian government. This trend is going to continue. And these are just the start. There's a map, if you look it up online, talking about European independence movements or European autonomy movements. The map is just startling at how many there are all across Europe. I mean, there's literally, just looking at it, you would think that it was a country map. That's how many of these there are. Dozens and dozens of them. So take a look at that and get educated on it, because this is where the West is headed, is this devolution. And the 51st state is another example of that, where people don't feel represented well enough in government. And even on the West side, they don't feel represented, you know, enough. They think that we're stealing all of their social programs and the money for their social programs. Okay, fine. Allow us then to better represent the vast majority of the people in these different areas. And this is kind of a basic principle. Also on the international front, Venezuela, 2,400% inflation. Five payments that were missed have a 30-day grace period. They made the payment last week on Thursday. I believe they've got another payment due tomorrow. And the fact of the matter is, markets, everybody was watching this to see if Venezuela would default, but they actually made their payment. Again, a cautionary tale. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal says investors brace for default. And I brought this up online, and I mean, this is the end result of socialism. Now, somebody was trying to argue with me about capitalism, and that socialism actually allows the productive members of society to succeed, and without it, there wouldn't be a safety net. This is a misunderstanding of economics, so let's define our terms. Capitalism, socialism, communism, fascism, those are all economic systems. And they are differentiated not by one being capitalistic and the other not. Actually, all systems are capitalistic. The question is who owns and controls the capital, the means of production. And in socialist systems, the capital is always, the means of production is always controlled by the government and may be in part owned by the government. In other words, key sectors like, well, I don't know, automakers and healthcare, those kind of things are owned by the government. Now, communism is probably the most honest system because everything is owned and controlled by the government. But when things are owned and controlled, that implies the necessity of centralization of power. And so socialism is despotism because there has to be that centralization of control that comes with that ideology. And when you have centralization of ownership, then you also have to have centralization of control. So you have this system that feeds on itself as a stepping stone really to true communism. Capitalism, free markets by the other end of the spectrum. Capital, the means of production, is owned and controlled privately. And the more it is, and the less centralization of control, the more the market can self-correct and the more prosperity there is. And so people were arguing me online about, and I just, people, they're not defining their terms. And thus, they get caught up in these things. Also on the national front, debt forgiveness being contemplated for Puerto Rico, $29 billion. And the governor saying that they might have 95% with power back by mid-December. Understand what that means, folks. It's almost 4 months without power. So this idea of 3 days food and water, it just doesn't cut it. We should be prepared. Now, we had a situation happen here in Spokane a couple years ago. We had 250,000 people without power, 10 days for some people. So it can happen in the United States. It is happening in the United States. Also on the national front, and this is kind of probably not shocking to a lot of people, but yeah, maybe it is. I don't know. There has been a CIA field report that was revealed in the latest book by Ed Klein, All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump, that details an FBI field report that makes the connection between an Oakland-based leftist group that went to Germany to meet with some anti-fascists in Germany and also with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. There shouldn't be a lot of surprise that there's collusion between the left and radical Islam, but an FBI field report bringing it out is pretty significant. Also on the national front, and this is kind of an interesting one, EMP threat. There's been a lot, boy, there's been a lot out there on the EMP issue and whether or not it's a real situation. Dr. Peter Pry and William Graham, experts in the field, okay, on EMPs, kind of put all of the downplaying to rest, specifically noting that the EMP Commission from 2001 to 2008 proved modern semiconductor electronics are far more vulnerable to EMPs than modern or than pre-modern 50s and 60s era electronics. In addition to that, those simulations, the Russians, I believe it was called Project K in 1961 and 62 over Kazakhstan, with a single weapon destroyed electric grids over an area larger than Western Europe. Anyway, they detail this. This article is going to be posted on Sunday. They detail this, that this threat is indeed real, and they have the facts to back it up. So it kind of gets past all the downplaying that's out there, and we just acknowledge what is a real threat. Also on the national front, and very interesting, this is fascinating to me. Part of the archives that are being released from the CIA indicate that the CIA had a report and a picture with a report that Adolf Hitler may have indeed survived World War II, gone to Colombia, and then fled to Argentina. And they list, this is coming from The Sun, you could take a look at this, fascinating read. CIA informant has a picture with Hitler and details when these things allegedly happened in the 1950s. So the CIA actually investigated it. Just a fascinating, if you love history, this is the stuff that's kind of intriguing when you start having hard facts and eyewitnesses come out on these kind of things. Very intriguing. So the other that was intriguing as well is with the JFK files being released, that there was the implication at least one of the documents, and not implication, the confirmation that there were two shooters. Very interesting stuff there. So I'm going to continue as those things come out, and I'll kind of put a summary together, and we can go through it at one of the shows later next week. But just fascinating stuff coming out right now. Also on the national front, November 4th, 100 years almost to the day of the Communist Revolution, Antifa is expecting to do violence throughout the United States of America. And now with this collusion with radical Islam, some are taking this threat very seriously, although every time they put a date out in the past, it's kind of fizzled out, so I think it might be a lot of hype, but we'll see. We've got to take these things serious, but I just think they're grasping at straws right now. They're losing so much support, momentum, credibility. Also on the national front, the Clinton collusion with the Russians, with the Uranium One scandal, continuing to move forward. Some people are asking, why is Mueller not looking at that? I agree. Why are you looking at something that happened before Trump's campaign with Manafort? So a lot of people keeping this in the news, and as things come out on that, this Uranium One scandal, we'll keep reporting it. On the regional front, Bundy Ranch trial down in Nevada, jury selection happening yesterday. Haven't got yet got an update. We'll probably have Sherry DeVale give us an update here next week on what's actually happening on the ground there. But Monday, jury selection. So a lot happening down in Nevada. On the local front, elections coming up, and you have quite a list of what I would describe as socialists that are running against the Spokane Valley City Council, and a lot of veterans on the other end. It's interesting that people that have been in the military know what the sacrifice is about. They tend to be conservative, and they tend to be very gentlemanly, gentlewomanly. And you see this attack happening in Spokane Valley because they want to turn it socialist. They think they've turned Spokane socialist. They want to turn Spokane Valley socialist. And you have veterans now, Caleb Collier being a former Marine, Rod Higgins being former Army, Ed Pace, former Army, Vietnam veteran, you know, moving from one battlefield to the next to protect our Constitution and our way of life here in Spokane Valley. So if you don't know about what's going on in Spokane Valley, get informed. You can go to voce.com, take a look at my recommendations. It's also up on Facebook, on Patriot Radio's Facebook page. And I explain in detail the differences between the candidates, and the choice is really clear. In fact, Ben Wick, who is the opponent of Ed Pace, you know, was the guy that many of you have heard me talk about, was the guy that supported the gas tax increase. And now they're coming out with ads trying to make the sitting council look like they were going to do tax increases, which is not true. And so, you know, we start seeing that stuff that they're losing, and they know that our education of the voters here in Spokane Valley is working. So get educated, educate your friends, family, and neighbors, and that's the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. Thank you to everybody that has been praying for us in the show. My wife is so wonderful. She's been doing some mission work. Just really terrific how small things like making coffee can turn into impacting lives for Jesus Christ overseas. It's amazing. So thank you for your prayers for her too. And also, if you get a chance, seriously, take a moment and go to Facebook.com/Patriot Radio US, like the page, share it with your friends and your family, and tell them about the show. Get them interested, get them educated, and help us to continue to spread the message of freedom and liberty, and hopefully educate more of this next generation. Well, my guest today is Billy Vaughn. He's a Gold Star father of a fallen Navy SEAL, Chief Aaron Carson Vaughn. And since his son's death, Billy has become an advocate for our warfighters, exposing the criminal rules of engagement, which have unnecessarily cost so many their lives. He's also the author of the book Betrayed, which details the days, weeks, and months after his son's death. And so it is very humbling, and it's also an honor to have you on Patriot Radio today, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Matt, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, I really appreciate, too, that you are now one of the newest members of the Understanding the Threat team. We love UTT here on Patriot Radio, so that's really good news.
Well, and it's certainly an honor to me and a privilege to even be working with John and the team. I'm just a dad, you know, and an American citizen, it's just really an honor to be working with them. I mean, they are such experts on the Islamic movement and the threat to our Western civilization, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your story, if you could. The listeners probably are not familiar with your story, or maybe even the book Betrayal, the shocking true story of Extortion 17. So if you could tell the listeners a little bit about the story and how you came to be involved.
Aaron was a member of SEAL Team 6, and on August 6, 2011, Aaron, our only son and oldest child, by the way, Karen and I, and my wife, Karen, and on August 6, 2011, Aaron, along with 29 other Americans, were flying into a hot landing zone, and their chopper was shot out of the sky, And on board were 17 Navy SEALs, 5 SEAL Team 6 support, and 5 Army and National Guard flight crew, and 3 Air Force Special Operations. And it was the single largest loss of in the history of naval special warfare, and in the days and the weeks after, the things that Karen and I began to find out were just astonishing, horrific, and just unimaginable. And they were flying in a 1960-some-odd CH-47C retrofitted to a D model in the 1980s, never built for assault operations, let alone nighttime assault operations, because we didn't have enough special operations helicopters to fly our special operators in at the time. There was no pre-assault fire when the chopper went in. And then even after the chopper was shot down because of the rules of engagement, the AH-64 Apaches and the AC-130 Spectre gunship, most lethal, you know, weapon, air weapons team the world has ever seen, were not allowed to take out the people who shot down the chopper because of the rules of engagement. So, you know, and you know, it's just been one thing after another, and there's so much I couldn't tell you, you know, about the black box, the 7 Afghans who were on the chopper who were not on the manifest, and you know, think the conflicting information about why the SEALs were going in when the AC-130 was saying there was nothing going on, it was unsafe to bring in another chopper, and the one story, the Rangers are being overrun, and at the same time, the Rangers on the ground testified, you know, we were not being overrun. We didn't ask for a quick reactionary force. We were told it was coming. No, I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you right now, Matt, but it's just like I said, it just goes on and on. And one thing that came from all this is you know, after Aaron's death, other warfighters and families begin to talk to Karen and I and everything, and it's just unbelievable how many of our warfighters have died under these criminal rules of engagement, and I believe that it's the parallels between the wars that we lost in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The parallels between that and what's going on in our country today are unbelievable, because our leadership is continuously in the military and in our government here in the country submitting to the enemy, and we're getting our warfighting instructions, we're getting our warfighting strategy, we're getting our strategy in our country from our Islamic Muslim Brotherhood advisors. And so That's one reason, one of the main reasons why I wanted to work with Understanding the Threat. There are many, you know, men and women out there who are doing amazing work about informing our nation, the citizens, about the threat that we have. But Understanding the Threat does something different. They actually help to equip citizens and law enforcement agencies, you know, to fight this threat.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened over there involving your son. What do you think, after all the investigation, after all the things that you've had to go through, if you could, and we've got some time, so take as much time as you need. What happened based on your investigation, and who do you think is responsible?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, when I tell you what I think happened, this may be the first time that I have said this publicly on the air, because always before, it's just, like I told you a while ago, the confusion of the op that night. I believe what happened, and this is not in my book. What is in my book was the information I had up until 2013. But since then, I've been able to figure out a lot of things and have been told a lot of things. And the reason, Matt, why there was the conflicting information that night, why, as the chopper was getting ready to leave FOB, Forward Operating Base Schenck, there in the Wardock province, and the AC-130 Spectre gunship, the electronic warfare's officer, the navigator, and the commander on that aircraft were saying, do not bring another chopper in. There's no reason. Everything on the ground is quiet. We have lost squirters on the ground. Squirters are enemy combatants. We've lost them on the ground. They have heavy weapons. We don't know where they are. But the Rangers on the ground, the Rangers were running an op, and it was over. They're in no danger. and everything's quiet, so there's no need to bring in another chopper. But the SEALs, I am told from intel sources, were getting information, and keep in mind, this is only a 15-minute flight away, so it's not like they were flying halfway around the world, but they were getting information that the Rangers on the ground were being overrun, and they had to get there as quickly as they could. And in fact, the landing zone was so hot that they didn't think a second chopper would make it in, so they all got on one chopper. They were getting that information, yet the air weapons team and the Ranger group on the ground was saying, hey, everything's fine here. I do know from testimony that in the top center, there was an American commander and there was an Afghan commander. And the Afghan commander actually told the American commander, if you can believe this, where the landing zone was, where the chopper was going to land that night. All of this is right there to read in black and white. And I believe that somebody was giving the American commander bad intel, telling him that the Navy SEALs needed to get there as quickly as they could. This is what I'm telling you is supposition, but it's right. But it's an educated supposition based on what I've read and based on what other people have looked at. It is the only reason in the world that I can come up with why the Navy SEALs were getting such different information from what the people on the ground and in the air above where the op actually was, from what they were seeing and what they were telling. And I believe that Afghan commander in that talk center with our American commander was telling that commander, those SEALs need to get there because I've got information those people in the air don't have. That's what I believe. I want your listeners to understand that is supposition. But this chopper was shot down in the landing zone. The Afghans absolutely knew where the landing zone was. I can show you that in black and white. And in fact, the air crew had to ask the Afghans as the chopper was coming in what a certain tower was that was right there in the landing zone in this village. And the Afghans told them that it was a tower where farmers hung crops. And this is all about 2:39 a.m. in the morning. And so the Afghans had every bit of the information and in fact gave it to the Americans as the chopper came in. And I believe, although I have no proof, it was the largest green-on-blue attack that we've witnessed in the Afghan war. And as I said, I don't think I've ever said that on the air, all that. There are a lot of things that even with that happening probably would have not been shot down. If they'd have been in a special operations chopper, if when the chopper came in, if the AH-64s had been allowed to lay down pre-assault fire and put the enemy down, you know, and out of the way, and if the AC-130, the AC-130 had requested multiple times, and here again, this is all in military testimony and in my book, they had requested multiple times to take out the squirters on the ground when they still had them in their sights, which they had them in their sights for a couple hours, by the way, and were denied time after time by American leadership that they couldn't take them out. If any of those things had happened, I believe the chopper wouldn't have been shot down. But go ahead.
No, so I'll let you continue, but let's talk about that very briefly. Why do you think, you know, when I was in Iraq, we had a couple times where we were told not to engage to be careful if we engaged. Why do you think they weren't allowed to fire on them when they had them in their sights for 2 hours, clearly identified them as enemy?
I think by 2011, we had in 2009, after President Obama became president, in Afghanistan, you know, they implemented the strategy, winning the hearts and minds. And I think by 2011, the rules of engagement had become so restraining on our warfighters that American commanders were absolutely afraid to do anything, knowing that there would be an investigation on just about every shot that they fired from an aircraft. And in fact, in testimony, the age 64 pilots, one of them from one of the aircraft testified that there's a one in a million chance we can ever get pre-assault fire approved, and the other one testified that we can almost never get pre-assault fire approved because there were questions as to why there was no pre-assault fire that night also, and it had just become a thing of almost never, and then. Like when the AC-130 actually argued back and forth with commanders or with a commander saying, hey, we can take these guys out. We can take these guys out. We've got them right here. We know they're bad guys. We've been watching them. And they were I don't know. I can only suppose based on what I know and the way things were then as to why they were not allowed because it was aggressive. To the Afghans, in fact, the AC-130 crew even testified that, in their opinion, there was 0% of CDE, and you know what that is, civilian damage estimate. They testified that, yet they still were not allowed to take these bad guys on the ground out. And these bad guys eventually became lost, and then the AC-130 had, you know, was saying over the radio that these guys have weapons, they got heavy weapons, and they're bounding down the valley, And these guys eventually ended up right in the landing zone and shot the chopper out of the sky. And I believe, and a lot of others believe, they knew where the landing zone was all along because they had quite a distance to travel from where they had engaged the Rangers and where the chopper, the Extortion 17, was shot down.
It's just, you know, when I hear stories like that, it's absolutely, I'll say it, inexcusable that some of those things happen. And I want to shift gears a little bit to talk about rules of engagement. There's a lot of Vietnam veterans that listen to Patriot Radio. And, you know, I remember when I was first getting in the service, I got an earful about rules of engagement and how horrible it was in Vietnam. What do you think? And also, you know, frankly, when I went into Iraq, we did not have armored vehicles other than our Humvees. Our big trucks were not armored at that time, other than what we kind of cobbled together to make, you know, as armored as possible. What do you think the rules of engagement are today, and the equipment levels, all those kind of different things today that should be fixed or improved? Because you've really become a proponent of making sure our rules of engagement fit the situation on the ground.
Well, let me just say this. You know, Karen and I support President Trump very much, and we think he's a good president. And you know, we've been on the radio, we've been on TV before talking about the rules of engagement, you know, and everything. And you know, the thing of it is I'm not a military expert. I never have been, but we were forced to learn these things. You know, after Aaron got killed and we began to find out things and we kind of became self-educated. And then President Trump became president and, you know, it came out that he was going to change the rules of engagement. And you know, I was glad and people cheered and we were all happy and all this kind of stuff. But I'm very disappointed that President Trump has gone back to war with the same generals who lost these two wars, with the same generals who've had 15 years. You know, Matt, we have a military the greatest the world has ever seen, and they can go out every single night and crush the enemy on the battlefield. I mean, absolutely crush the enemy, but we can't win a war. And now we have generals who don't talk about victory. They talk about managing the war. This has never been pleasant for me to talk about because when Aaron got killed, we were shocked, disappointed, and heartbroken about what we found in the upper levels of our military. But they do not have our warfighters back. And if you think about this, just think about what happened over in Niger, where here again we sent warfighters out on a mission, and we had the equipment to protect those warfighters with drones that would have warned them that an ambush was coming. But because of the ROE in that area, we did not have them out with those guys on that mission. And so here we go again, and I believe these ROE are absolutely, and I know the guys, the Vietnam veterans talk about this, and it was the same kind of war. You had the politicians fighting the wars, but I believe now it's even worse because we are actually getting our war fighting strategy from the enemy, if you can believe that. Just think, if we had been getting our warfighting strategy to fight the Nazis from Nazis that we called allies, where would we be today? I mean, you know, from certain Nazis that we deemed all right, that we were getting our warfighting strategy from them. Where would we be today? But that is exactly what we're doing with the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, in Niger, wherever we are. Wherever our warfighters are over there fighting these jihadis, we are getting our strategy from Muslim men inside our government or at least having the ear of our government, of our generals, of our DOD, and telling them how to get along and how to best win this war over there. And it is getting our warfighters killed.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up because it's very clear the Muslim Brotherhood is infiltrated in ways that are just unbelievable to the average American. People would be just stunned if they understood the level of infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S. government, and that has been very well documented. But if you could, what are your concerns about it, and who, where and who should people look to get educated on something like that and the level of infiltration that has occurred in our government? Because very clearly, some of those people that have the ear of our leaders have led us astray. No question about it. Intentionally, I believe, based on the documents that were introduced in the Holy Land Foundation trial.
And yes, and that's right. And they still are. And our leaders still continue to be blind. I mean, even in this attack just a couple days ago, we've got leaders there in New York that are saying again, Islam is not the problem, the mosque is not the problem, and I think you had Governor Cuomo said, we will not let them beat us, or we will not let them defeat us. Well, my gosh, they are defeating us. We have dead Americans. We have dead Americans in an American city. While a governor stands there and says we're not going to let them beat us, and they are, and our leaders will still not call the enemy and identify the enemy and identify the problem, so that they can defend the American citizen against this threat. In fact, I believe that on the federal level, that our government has become so compromised that it can no longer act in the best interest of the American citizen. So, to try to answer your question, I believe what we have to do is American citizens have to begin to educate themselves. Here is understanding the threat, willing to do that, and local law enforcement has to be educated, and local law enforcement has to be the first line of defense against this threat, this Muslim Brotherhood threat, this Islamic threat that now is in practically every city and town in our United States, in the schools, in compromised our churches. I'm a believer, and I cannot believe for the life of me how the Christian church will not stand up against this. I'm afraid if our churches don't stand up, we may not win this war. With me, I would have never thought that we could lose a war in Afghanistan and in Iraq with the military that we have. But when I look at what happened there and over 7,000 dead Americans and tens of thousands wounded and thousands of families changed, we need to wake up and realize that even though we're the greatest nation on this earth, we could lose this war right here in our country, this same war, if we don't wake up. And there again, that's why I feel so privileged to be working with Understanding the Threat, because when I met John And I realized, you know, what they were doing and the, first of all, the intelligence and the knowledge they have and how they're equipping citizens. You know, Matt, I know you know this. On September 11th, 2001, our bureaucratic, bloated federal government was unable to defend this nation's citizens in three attacks against jihadis. But in a fourth attack, American citizens stood up, gave all, and defended this country. And if we're to win this war against this Islamic threat inside our country, it'll be American citizens that win it. It will not be the federal government.
So in the last couple minutes that we have left, how do you think, you know, I really would hope that Trump would eventually, I was hoping he would do it earlier than this. I still have hope he's going to do it. But declare officially the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliated organizations terrorist organizations inside the United States of America. Do you think that's possible?
I think it's possible, but I'm afraid that, you know, President Trump has had some very good people in the NSC fired by General McMaster as soon as McMaster became his NSC director. And I'm afraid, and one of the first things that McMaster came out publicly and said is we don't need to use the term radical Islamist because it makes the jihadis mad. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it, but that's what he said. And so that is the man that we have who has the president's ear. So I believe it's becoming more and more difficult for President Trump to do these things because it looks to me like, and I don't know, but just from looking afar, it looks like he is becoming surrounded more and more with people who have been in this for a long time, like John McCain, and they are a lot of the problem with fighting this Muslim threat. That's my belief. But, yes, I believe if President Trump gets the right information, he will act on it. I do still have that confidence in him that I believe he will, man.
You know, I'm kind of sick and tired of people here in America that will say, you know, you guys are just trying to look for war with the Islamists. The war is happening. We just have to acknowledge the fact it is happening. And, oh, by the way, happening on our streets as evidenced by New York 2 days ago. We need to take the threat seriously and we need to do something about it. So if people want to get more educated, they want to learn more about you and they want to maybe even purchase your book, where can they go to do that?
Well, they can buy the book Betrayed off Amazon, or they could actually buy it off mine and Karen's website, which is For Our Son, FOROURSON.US. They can buy the book there. If they want to get educated about the Islamic threat, they need to go to Understanding the Threat. To their website, and I promise you that John Guandolo and Chris Gobbets can give them all Americans all the information that they need to educate them on this threat.
Well, we have about 60 seconds left. A specific message you might have to the young people out there, the millennial generation that may think, "Oh, this is all overblown." And our country's always done well. We don't need to worry about that. What will be your message to that next generation?
Okay. I'll tell you what, that's an excellent point. That is excellent because that generation, you know, they just seem to not have a clue. And it's two things they can do. One is they can become educated about what Islam is. And about who the jihadis say they are, because they do not mind telling us who they are. We just refuse to believe them. The second thing they can do is just look at history. Two things out of history. This is a 1,400-year-old war. This enemy is very patient. They don't have to win tomorrow. They don't mind if it takes them 100 years. The other thing is no nation has ever gone on like the United States has and continued to exist as a world power. It just hasn't happened. And I believe it hasn't happened because people, generation after generation, becomes like we are. You know, me, it's always been this way. We've always had a great country. It's hard to believe that life could be any other way. Well, if it's hard for me, at age 60 to believe that. It's certainly hard for someone who's a generation or two behind me, because that's all they know. We're not like the rest of the world, and that's all they can see. And, you know, our founders, when they said, in the Declaration of Independence, where they said God gives us inalienable rights, and among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those rights don't just belong to Americans. They belong to men and women and boys and girls all over the world. They're all given by God. But only in America are we able to exercise those rights, because men and women and freedom, men and women sacrificing, has helped to keep it where we can exercise those rights given by God. So look at the rest of the world. Let them look at the rest of the world and look at history and see that it takes diligence all the time, 24 hours a day, to keep this republic free.
Amen. Very well said. And your sacrifice, I don't even know what that would be like to lose a son, but thank you very much for turning that into something that can continue our republic for the next generation. May the Lord bless you. Love to have you on again, Billy. Thank you again for being on Patriot Radio today.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate you letting me be on.
All right. Billy Vaughn, Understanding the Threat, also author of Betrayed, The Shocking True Story of Extortion 17. Just absolutely heartbreaking hearing some of those stories from the ground. And I know there's a lot of Vietnam veterans out there listening right now, a lot of Iraq veterans out there listening right now that are just shaking their heads. Yep, that happened to me too in modern times. But you know something? Like Billy said, it's going to be us. It's going to be us that is going to fix this. You and me, not some politician in Washington, D.C. or Olympia or Boise. It's going to be you and me. And I hope that encourages you, if you're a veteran, to get back on the battlefield back here at home. This is Matt Shea. Thank you once again for joining me on Patriot Radio today. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation the greatest one.